Well, hey, everybody, welcome. I hope you're all doing great and are reflecting on your relationship with money and your money story and looking at what you may want to change. I reviewed some of the questions, the answers to the questions that you sent in and the things you'd like to address. There are a couple that I want to specifically address because they're not ones I'm able to incorporate in the discussion. And also offer this. There are a couple of questions. There are actually some questions that kind of cluster around setting and collecting professional fees in coaching particularly. And that's not just a minute or two. I need a management of background noise so I don't have to go. I'm not on lecture mode now because I want to get interactions and responses. And I'd like to hold that if you'll manage the background noise. I want to offer, hanging around after the top of the hour, our final seminar next week, to just have a discussion with you and talk about the things that you still have questions or comments about that you want to add or ask or just go into in a bit more detail or even apply, like maybe especially the issues around professional fees that a number of you have asked that I want to cover more thoroughly. I want to address a couple of the questions and then open it up for any other comments or additions. And this is from Amy specifically, how I can understand and unravel beliefs about money that I may not know about, beliefs that may be holding me back or holding my clients back. Really an excellent question. To know to ask is half the answer because so many of the issues are from that 90 to 95% of our operating system that is not conscious. So the definition of an unconscious bias is it's not conscious. The beliefs that we have, the various aspects, the blind spots, we can't see them. So there are many aspects. That's why I included in the resources of what you printed, hopefully, the ABCs of money mistakes and financial fallacies. And I list, I think there are 27 there, and I divided it into a cluster of four components, the ABCs, the affect, the mistakes and fallacies based on emotion, the behavioral ones that show in behavior, the cognitive one that distort our thinking or create a particular pattern of thinking that may not work, and the sensation, the various aspects. You'll see the list of ones there, and I listed those and described them and illustrated them just so that you would recognize them when you hear them from your clients, because over time you're going to hear a number of those and they will be disguised even from the client. But when you have your radar cued to listen in those ways and begin to think in additional ways, I think that can be a benefit to you to get curious together in a collaborative way with your client. And we can talk about that more in the discussion after our last seminar next week. Another question is about how do you determine what your fees should be, about how to frame that, how to think about that. I'll describe some things as we do a little bit more discussion of it, but two things. One is there's a blog that's archived at the CTA site about professional fees. It's the 9 or 10 things that are the most common mistakes new coaches make. And there's a very simple way to calculate your fee. There are only 3 variables when you think about it. Now, again, you will be able to look at all kinds of things for additional income, but let's keep it simple to say, let's just talk about individual coaching clients. There are 3 variables. One is the amount of money you make. The others, how much you charge and how much you work. Pick 2 of those and calculate the third. Let's say you decide you want to work 11 months a year, have 15 clients you meet once a week, and let's say you decide you want to make $200,000 a year. You do the math. you charge a monthly retainer of $1,115. Now, here's a part of that answer that is about framing, because this is something you may be aware of, but really may not have conceptualized it in terms of your fee. Price provides a context of value. You see a $100 shirt marked down to $60, there's a context of value. That $100 is an initial frame of value, an anchor. Now, that's a principle here because in an area like professional coaching, there's not an absolute standard. No insurance company sets the rate. You may have, in my view, mistakenly looked at what other coaches are charging because most coaches don't charge nearly enough. So think about it in this way. If you walk in, think about it from the standpoint of the client, okay? You walk into a restaurant and you see entrees that are priced $17 to $24. You see one entree, lobster, at $5.95. What do you think? Is that the last? No, that's the never thing you would purchase in that restaurant. Or I come to your door and say, hey, I've got a brand new BMW 540 out here. I'll sell it to you for $2,200. What's your question? What's the matter with it? Or what's the matter with you, Kruger? So framework provides meaning, and it also provides a sense of value. So what's a fair price? Picasso was approached by a woman who insisted he paint her portrait. He then turned over a paper placard at a sidewalk cafe, quickly drew her likeness. And she said, you captured my essence in a few strokes. Amazing. How much do I owe you? Picasso replied, $5,000. She said, what? How could you want so much? It only took you a few seconds. No, ma'am. It took me my entire life and a few more seconds. So what do you want to charge for your services? I want you to think about that and think about the value and what you convey when you do that and the frame of mind you're in when you state your fee. Remember, I mentioned the Wharton School of Business study that of all the variables, confidence and clarity in the recommendation, the professional recommendation, was the major factor that determined whether someone signed on or not. So there are some models. I'll elaborate a little bit, but I really want to discuss this in some more detail about some practical ways that we can think about it. But I think of three or four models. One is the massage model. You charge for a 45-minute unit at a time, and the client, and you go about your business until the client decides to engage you again. You charge piecework per session. Another, the formula that I just described of how much you want to make a year, how many hours, calculated. Another, the Tony Robbins model. $1 million a year plus 10% of increased revenue and profitability. And a fourth is really kind of like number two, a simple monthly retainer that reflects your value and communicates that to your client. And you both live into the full measure of the value of the experience and its benefit. And remember, when you ask a question about fair in adulthood, there's no ultimate arbiter of fairness. There's no longer a parent to appeal to settle what's fair. God doesn't reach down to influence fairness at an earthly level. So the adult version of fairness does not exist. Is it fair that a physician makes 10 times as much for the time with a patient as the nurse does, even when the nurse spends significantly more time and does more care? Or that the playing field was never level to start with? Or will it be ever that things are not fair? But that will not have a bearing on your professional feed, but I want to elaborate about that. I hear some background noise. Let me ask if there are any questions or additions at this point, because I want to move into our discussion, but I just want to sort of torque your thinking about it a little bit to begin to think about some things that you may have thought about but not been satisfied with about money and your life, your professional fees, your money story that we can discuss a bit more next time, and especially I think it'll have more meaning after we go through the seven steps and finally that last step next time of Program New Identity, the core identity. Anything to add or ask at this point? And I promise you I'll get to the questions that you sent in, and they're very, very helpful. But anything else to add or ask at this point, just briefly? I'll put us on lecture mode, and I'm thinking we'll have a few minutes at the end, so hold on. Okay, we've discussed the concept of your money story, your relationship with money, and last time we discussed the first three steps of understanding and changing that story, how to recognize, own, and assess your money story. In this seminar, we'll discuss the next two steps. Decide what to change and map changes of your money story. So step four is to decide what to change in your money story. I'm going to describe a study and have you guess the biggest change impact. Now, a couple of you have heard the story or read it from some of my stuff before, but you're on mute, so you're clear, okay? Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects chose a different option from poles of contrasting behavior, lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive. They would pick one and behave that way for the entire day. So like an introverted person would act like an extrovert for the day. And the next day they'd have a different choice and pick one. Additionally, twice a week, they would stretch to behave in a way outside their usual pattern. They would read something they'd never read before twice a week and eat something twice a week they'd never read before. So what do you think was the biggest change in this group after 4 months? Well, the remarkable finding actually baffled the research team. They couldn't figure out what had happened or why it had happened. The subjects lost an average of 11 pounds, and 6 months after that, almost everyone had continued to lose weight and kept the weight off. Now, they were baffled because this wasn't a diet. It was a study focusing on change and its impact. This, I believe, is a prototype study of exactly what we do in coaching with each client. Choice architecture. To have someone look at behavior that had been automatic or default, to actually think about the decision and be aware that they're deciding, that it's not happening until they decide. So they become aware of every aspect of their behavior. They begin to think about, is this food in my best interest? Is this bite even in my best interest? Because think about how we usually eat. We'll maybe enjoy the first two or three bites and then kind of get in a zone or a conversation or some thought, and that's it. And then we finish. We eat everything that's in front of us. So this is a very different way to look at each bite as a choice, which, of course, it is. Now, every thought and feeling is a choice. Whatever you think, feel, and experience, you choose each moment. Whatever you experience, you either accept or create. So this study illustrates how everything we do is a choice. It just makes the choice each moment in a here and now way conscious and specifically focused. And think about how we do that every time with every interaction with our clients. We focus on exactly what their choice is and help them create a map. What's next? What's the plan? Where they want to get to? So remember last seminar we discussed the equation belief drives behavior, behavior drives performance. Now, for this step, decide what to change, I want to add an equation. This is in your outline. It captures the principle that we create our reality or agree to it. Event plus response equals outcome. Every outcome you experience is a result of how you respond to an event or create that in your life. Achievement's an outcome. It's not what happens to us, but our response to what happens to us and what we create that makes the difference. Remember this essential principle for ownership of your money story. In adulthood, you either create or allow everything that happens to you. You worked out, so now you feel more energy and alertness. That's the outcome. You didn't attend to marketing, now your business is slumping. You've spent more than you've earned, so now you're in debt. Choice is part of a mindset. The antithesis of choice is also a mindset. This is how that sounds. Fate, luck, circumstance, bad traffic, things just happen, I can't do it. All of the coachable moments of what a client will say can be added to this right here, to this beginning list. The absence of the awareness of choice limits possibility. So this is exactly what we're doing with our money story, because this is what we do with ourselves first and then our clients. We recognize that it's not there until we create it. Now, think about it in a little bit of a different way. Whatever you're doing that you can't control is your addiction. You can be addicted to a substance, a behavior, such as spending beyond your means, to a process, such as debt, a certain kind of relationship, or to compromised results. Money is energy. Anyone addicted to anything has difficulty regulating energy. So here's another notion to consider. Obstacles and desires. And I think this is especially important, and I want to apply it to coaching specifically. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. Let me say that in a more specific way. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. In other words, rather than strategizing to overcome or avoid or defeat an obstacle or presenting it as a noun, as if it's something like an entity that it's doing something to you. My anxiety stopped me. My doubt paralyzed me. Consider simply not creating it. It's there when you create it. Consider using your energy to generate something else instead. Now, there's a secret here. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want that makes it safe if you're ambivalent or afraid. Here's an illustration of this. I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash, barking ferociously at a cat as if to say, "Here's a lemme at him." Now, the next frame, the cat was not shabby at all. It actually looked mean, at least as big as the dog. And then in the next frame, all of a sudden, with the dog barking ferociously, "Just lemme at him," the leash snapped, so the dog was free to go after the cat. He looked back, saw it, looked scared to death, quickly ran back, grabbed the leash, tied a triple knot, then could again safely strain at the leash and bark his fiery, "Just lemme at him." Another example of this dialectic of obstacle and desire. If you view a scene in a film you don't want to see, you may cover your face with your hands to say, "No, I don't want to look." But then the desire creeps in and you peek through your fingers at what you're drawn to see. The obstacle makes looking acceptable. So when you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, "I can't find time to exercise. I can't put away anything for savings," reflect on the underlying desire, because that's what's motivating it. Now, this is the coaching principle. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Imagine what it would be like not to create your obstacles and instead put your energy into what you want. For example, a primary obstacle that people give for not participating in retirement plans include fear of finances, inertia, procrastination, or other pressing financial demands. So here's an example of how you can frame something to make a good deal of difference. When companies automatically enroll their employees in a retirement saving plan, the employee then has to opt out to not participate, to actually make a choice that says, I will not save for my future. So when it's automatic like that, it's 100% initially. Then it levels off to between 86 and 94% over time. Now, framed differently, at companies where it isn't automatic, someone has to choose to opt in, 20% participate. That's a fourfold difference. So think about how you can make a good choice once, like deciding to set up an automatic withdrawal from your checking account to a retirement account of a specific amount of money, same time each month, automatically. You don't have to decide it each time. Now, here are some things that I think will be helpful in coaching and understanding in coaching, because I think it's useful to understand when we engage the process of change. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change. So first I want to look with you at how the brain opposes change so that we can see how to use this information to facilitate success. One, people have prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. Existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts, simply because it can't happen any other way. So we began always with where the client is, not with where we are. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. Remember when I gave the illustration at the beginning of our first seminar, whenever someone has a belief, knows a fact, or has information, that's an anatomical reality in their brain. You don't suddenly change that by presenting another fact or belief to override it. So we recognize what someone believes and begin a process collaboratively about creating a different way of looking at it, to reframe it, to engage, and look at it in a new or different way. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. Now, as we mentor, coach, and co-create change, always we have to start with where the client is, not with where we are. And people are not always aware of their prior knowledge. I want to discuss next time in the discussion section a couple of questions about, you know, how do you deal with somebody who has just a very definite belief? Or how do you know what somebody believes? Really great questions that I want to address also. But this is kind of a preface for that too. And four, when changes occur in a systematic and consistent way, new connections are made in the brain. New maps are created. So, again, the answer to significant change is not the goal. Winners and losers have the same goals. It's the system. And that's what we're looking at here. So, let's look then at how the brain opposes change. Because I think these are 10 things, each of which you will encounter, and I think it'll be helpful to understand them to help you facilitate and catalyze change in your clients. Since the brain has a mind of its own, I think we need to consider how our brains work in order to strategically plan change with our clients. Each of these 10 precepts will help you craft a new money story and facilitate change in your client. Now, the principles are so simple, they're almost elusive. One, change generates discomfort. Whenever we repeat things, we hardwire them. They become habits. They're hardwired in our brain, and our mind software creates the kind of structure to ensure that we know exactly what's going to happen, and mind and brain work together. Neuronal pathways and neural nets, the highways and villages in our brain, become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation, to make routine behaviors easy. As we've talked before, you drive the same way to work every day. After a month or two, you don't have to think about it. You can listen to an audiobook. When these habits are confronted and have to change, though, the autopilots in the midbrain get disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process this thinking. So this is something that you will see with every client, and I believe it will be helpful to understand and to help your client understand and to reframe the discomfort of doing something new, different, unexpected. The discomfort and uncertainty that someone has in taking each new step, and each of us have experienced that repeatedly, will result in some kind of discomfort. So I think it's helpful to frame that discomfort as validation of progress, of moving ahead, of being in new territory, an indication of change, not as my intuition's telling me this is the wrong thing or my gut's saying this is wrong, but simply a way that you can reframe it so that each time you experience that discomfort, it becomes a validation of progress rather than a sign to head for cover. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expressions. Beliefs can actually turn genes on and turn them off. I heard Ray Kurzweil say this, and it's in his book, The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. The way he put it, civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. That's what we want to ultimately get to with the best stories. Two, change creates dissonance. And this is exactly what we've been talking about just now, that we see what we expect to see, what our radar has been coded for, and any change is going to create a kind of discomfort, a kind of dissonance that's not what we expect. A portion of your medial frontal cortex has the job description to recognize and correct errors. That's the error detection mechanism. So consider what that part of your brain does for debt. The real expense of buying something you can't afford is you have to pay more for it. Then the emotional expense of your mind and dissonance to recognize that spending is different from affording. Then you have to pay the interest. Triple work. Now that all balances with the immediate hit of dopamine with the anticipation of spending. So here's the payback. You can deceive others, even your own mind, but your brain always knows. Now the good news, this neural machinery can both recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior by responding to mistakes. Now this is great if we remember to determine that it's a mistake versus a neural response to change itself. Important distinction. Three, the brain is a prediction machine. I'd like you to take down some numbers, write down some numbers, because I want to ask you a question about. One, two, four, five, seven, eight. What's missing? Usual answers, maybe three and six, maybe even multiples of three. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of six numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought something was missing, is inside your head, informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs two times in a row, the brain predicts a third repetition. A stock goes up two quarters in a row, the brain predicts a third rise will follow. This is an example. A company increased profits 26 quarters in a row and announced earnings of 23 cents per share when the projection was 24 cents a share. The analyst missed it by one penny. The company loses $1.5 billion in market value in 5 minutes. Now, what changed in those 5 minutes? The company's intrinsic value and balance sheet didn't change, but the mindset of the investors did temporarily. J. Paul Getty said there are three elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. See, you can tell how the brain prediction of pattern is also a basis of some jokes, listing two things, then a third non sequitur, set up, payoff. This is how our brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions of repeated events. It makes it sometimes a challenge to override both emotion, especially if there's an emotional trigger that's etched with an experience, and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. So we need to be sure we predict and envision the right things. Four, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. Which do you think works better, threats or reinforcements? Now, from being a coach and from knowing neuroscience, that we get what we focus on, not what we want, the answer, of course, is neither. Both are likely to backfire. Studies show that focus on either one is a focus on the negative, on the being late. Whether you respond positively or negatively, it's still a focus on being late or not being late. So we assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says avoid change. Change is read as an error. So there's also a specific portion of your brain that says, let's stay where we are and don't change it. Now, those of you who have been around me much at all have heard me say this. You do not have to be motivated to do something. You'll hear again and again, oh, I just need to be motivated to get to lose weight, to eat better, to work out, to save money. You don't need to be motivated. The pro athletes and actors I work with, they are not motivated to get up and go to the gym every day. But they do because it's what they decide to do, because they need to do that in order to do what's next. You don't need motivation. You only need two things, a plan and stick to it. A plan, the system, the map, that's what we specialize in as coaches, and sticking to it. That's what we get the client to commit to do, and they make a commitment to themselves out loud to us as an accountability partner. Now, six, emotions change brain functioning. When emotions are triggered, brain chemicals, dopamine and adrenaline, are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. This is so important in regulation and in planning and sticking to a plan. This is why self-talk is limited. One of the philosophers, I didn't say great philosopher, one of the philosophers of the 21st century really put this simply. He said, everybody's got a plan till they're punched in the mouth. Mike Tyson. So here's what we know now. The possibility of a reward induces dopamine. The anticipation of spending induces dopamine. It's not the reward that causes this spike, but it's the anticipation. When gamblers were studied, their brain firing of dopamine spiked just before they touched the slot machines. And also, the less predictable a reward is, the longer and stronger the dopamine neurons fire. So this is something important to remember when someone is planning something. Remember from college, whatever it was, where the laboratory mouse appeared, maybe genetics, maybe what. When the mouse in the maze was given regular predictive reward for pushing a lever, the behavior would stop quickly when the food pellet stopped. But if the food pellets were intermittent, infrequent, unpredictable, the mouse will keep pushing the lever almost indefinitely and at times to exhaustion and death. If, as long as it's unpredictable, it keeps going. So when somebody makes a commitment to not respond to somebody that they particularly are having difficulty with, you have to do 100%. If you don't respond 99 times out of 100, it's going to continue. It's even probably going to get more embedded. You know, it's sort of like in Texas, I don't want to be a fish in a lake that has water 99% of the time. Got to be 100%. And people can fall unconsciously into the pursuit of dopamine and the pleasure that is involved. 7, stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us provide a little bit of stress short-term, enhance learning. But the time window is only about up to 2 hours. For longer periods of time, 4 hours or more, things go the other direction with stress or excitement, and it compromises learning. It even compromises memory. So the most important success strategy, I believe, for our clients is regulation of states of mind and managing emotions. Closure to novelty is another aspect that occurs with repeated experiences in a particular context. An example, I see this resistance of coaching in family succession of business. The patriarch found everybody in the family and the company had been doing the same thing for 32 years, and suddenly there's a succession plan. Everybody's role, everybody's behavior involve change. Relationships involve change. Now, there are two final principles I think are huge in strategizing change. 9, neurogenesis, the creation of new brain cells, occurs in two ways. An enriched environment, which if you think about it, is exactly what we do in coaching, and exercise. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in their hippocampal cells. What's your guess about how much exercise increases those cells in mice? 100% increase in the number of cells in the hippocampus. Now, recent studies, non-invasive studies of humans, have shown an exact parallel. Studies have been done. London taxicab drivers, which have complex things to know and act, and University of Hamburg medical students. Whenever someone has a stimulating environment and exercise, it increases the number of cells in the hippocampus. Why is this important? The hippocampus is the primary location of two things, creativity and memory. Also the finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. Things go the opposite direction, especially in the hippocampus. Also, and 10, neuroplasticity simply means the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons, rezoning, developing cortical real estate. Here's an illustration. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment. They had a headgear with a visual apparatus that exactly reversed their image. Down was up, up was down, 24 hours a day. So they had to be very careful about everything they did. They each noticed about day 25 their brains automatically made the adjustments. They rewired. They didn't have to move about so carefully. The brain to develop new neural pathways. Now, another group of astronauts, a sort of a control group, were out of the headgear for 24 hours at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on to make the adjustments. This, I think, has to do with and emphasizes consistency. When we work consistently, when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains, and there's a significant role for consistency in that. So, step five, map changes. It's a true story. A man approached J.P. Morgan many, many years ago, before anybody knew the stuff we're talking about, held up an envelope and said, "In my hand, I have a guaranteed formula for success, which I will gladly sell you for $25,000. Now, that's back when $25,000 was some real money. So, of course, I think if I've got $7 in my wallet, I'm doing okay. "Sir," J.P. Morgan replied, "I don't know what's in the envelope, but if you show it to me and I like it, I'll give you my word as a gentleman, I'll pay you what you ask." Well, considering the alternatives, the man agreed to the terms, handed over the envelope. J.P. Morgan opened it, extracted a single sheet of paper, gave it one look, handed the piece of paper back to the man, wrote him a check for $25,000. There were two sentences on the page. "Every morning, write a list of things that need to be done that day. Do them." Is that exactly what we do in coaching? Is that have a plan and stick to it? So, finally, I want to end with six crucial elements to map change for this step. And we'll talk about how to understand and incorporate each of these six as an outline to master your money story. One is to regulate states of mind. When we are grounded and centered, we have access to all of the information in all of our states of mind. And our states of mind are like software programs. They're a mind-body state that determines how we perceive and how we process information. So, one example, Dr. Vernon Smith won a Nobel Prize in economics by demonstrating how market bubbles are created. He did a series of experiments with economics graduate students, sophisticated people in PhD programs. They were informed the fair value of a security was $3. So they knew the actual worth of security, which is a significant advantage over the Wall Street trader situation because it's an auction. People pay whatever they bid for it, and they have to outbid somebody. So what happened in price bidding? When they knew the value was $3, they ran the price up significantly past the $3 mark. When other traders in the experiment stopped paying a premium, the laboratory market crashed. The value in most of the studies was in the $5 range when they knew the value was $3 before it crashed. In a second experiment, group of faculty of economics students did the same experiment, repeated it. Their jacked up value was in the $4 range. So this is how someone can get in a state of mind and form bubbles and get in the euphoria. States of mind are like software programs. And we each have a different set of states of mind, relaxation, alertness, anxiety. A primary component is to regulate a state of mind and then be able to enter a zone of practice and performance that's consistent. The number two element of change, the power is in the focus. We've talked about this before, and this is from both quantum physics and neuroscience, that we have energy fields. And this is what Einstein talked about when he talked about the unified field theory. And this is about the energy that we possess, how we focus it and look at understanding it and its impact. What we do with this can make a significant difference. A buddy of mine has done some work at UCLA as a neuropsychiatrist called the quantum Zeno effect. This simply means the mental act of focused attention activates and holds in place brain circuitry. With consistent focus and repetition, these chemical links become stable changes in the brain structure. The brain rewires. So this is also the importance of focus and consistency. And the paradox is we don't attract what we want. We attract what we focus on. We pursue what we focus on. So everybody wants more money, so wanting is not the key to having it. Focusing on scarcity attracts scarcity. Focusing on prosperity can align your energy to pursue prosperity. So remember, the unconscious doesn't know the difference, doesn't register positive or negative, just the focus, kind of like a print or a negative is the same image. Your unconscious is that image. So here are a couple of examples of a focus that will backfire. I want to get out of debt. Focus is on debt. I want to lose weight. Focus is on overweight. 3, visualize changes. This is something important, and you will see in your resources section more of an explanation about how to use visualization in your coaching. And we can talk about applications of this, but you'll see more of an explanation about how visualization with consistency rewires your brain and how affirmations become the software that support the story of the visualization. 4, insight changes the brain. If you hook someone up to an fMRI and look at what happens to their brain at a moment of insight, an aha moment, 3 different parts of the brain light up, and someone is vaulted into a state that is more synthetic, integrative, and creative. Here's what happens when someone is given a fact, simply an idea, information, a directive. Nothing happens. No part of the brain lights up. Now, as important as insight-induced change is, the sustained attention and systematic approach is what hardwires it and creates the effectiveness. 5, take action. Remember, that's the last question we ask of a client. What are you going to do about it? The world will not pay you for what you know. It will pay you for what you do. So to analyze and plan are important, but payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan, set it into motion. Now, it may not be perfect, but they self-correct, keep moving forward organically, and learn from their mistakes and produce results. In other words, apply a growth mindset. And finally, 6 is what we'll talk about more next time as the final step, transform identity. A new experience, any change, needs to be focused on consistently and frequently and incorporated into a transformation of an operating model, in other words, identity. If change is to be permanent for anyone, it needs to be incorporated into identity. If it's not, you'll revert back to your identity. That's the most powerful force of the human psyche. We always revert to our identity. So this is especially what we want to look at and focus on in coaching, is to help someone transform the model of how and who they are and how they operate. So one final application of steps 4 and 5 to decide and map change is a debt story. And there are 3 exercises under debt story in step 5 in the workbook. A debt cycle can be a stealth cycle. You can fulfill a desire you didn't know you had by spending money you don't have. You can define yourself by acquisitions not paid for. You can even borrow based on how much money you'll be lended rather than how much money you can pay back. Spending money generates the perception, both by the spender and the observer, of having money. In fact, fulfilling a wish can create the desire. When desires define identity, it can be unrelenting. Many people who fall into debt don't have psychological problems necessarily, but spending has taken on a life of its own. With spending, the chase is on. They try to afford what they buy, and money can never buy what it represents emotionally. And it's hard to say because of the way our minds work and our brains are wired. It's hard to resist the immediate pleasure of buying, the pleasure center of dopamine release. Spending money can be addictive. It changes the state of mind. And it's really hard to substitute a theory like a future need, like long-term saving, like retirement, for the immediate. The most common way we're short-sighted in our decision-making is we choose a small amount of something now rather than a larger amount in the future. So these are things to think about and to apply. Here's an example you've probably heard about before, but it kind of represents something that may generate some thought. To tangibly calculate what you spend and what it would be in the future. Here's an example. Investing $1.50 a day beginning at age 20, based on the stock market average growth that's averaged since 1926, by age 65, you'll have $1 million. You wait until age 21 instead of 20, the difference is $109,000. Now, let's say at age 18, you invest $2,000 a year in an IRA and then stop all investing by age 30. By age 65, be worth $1 million. So here's one recent economic study showed that credit card holders are consciously aware of only $4 of every 10 that they owe. Now, I'm not talking about just being a few dollars or a few hundred dollars off, but actually not knowing what they owe on credit cards. The very first client, this was eye-opening for me, the very first client I had as a professional coach, someone who had waited until I was ready to make my transition to do this, it took her about 3 or 4 months into our coaching for her to confess that she had over $500,000 of credit card debt, and she was having increasing difficulty keeping it from her husband. Now, I can't say any more about the specifics because it could be recognizable, but this is someone who really knew what was happening but had gotten into that spiral of debt. Now, here's what an expert had to say. Uncle Junior to his nephew, Tony Soprano. You know, your father and me started that poker game over 30 years ago. We were talking one night about how the credit card companies, you know, they work their angle, how they don't care what you bought as long as you don't pay all at once. They juice you to death, and you thank them for letting you have a card. You'd rather be juiced than pay all at once. It's a certain kind of player. That's why we call it the executive game. So we render money an abstraction and deceive ourselves, and we put it off to the future. We make it an abstraction. Well, I can do it on my credit card, and it won't be an immediate expense. And Richard Medley said this very simply. Free money makes you stupid. Of course, it's not free. And remember this from everything you heard. I want to close with this statement. Right now, saving and the future are both abstractions. There will be a time when they both become very real for each of you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're in discussion mode now. I'm interested in thoughts or questions, anything you want to add or ask or clarify from what we've talked about.
Hey, Dave, it's Peter Grace from Buffalo.
Welcome. Hey, how are you?
Good. How you doing?
Doing great.
Good. Thank you very much for this. There's a lot in this.
It's really compressed, and I would much prefer a seminar type where we have discussions and stuff, but there's so much I want to give you guys. Go ahead.
Well, I have two questions. One is, what's the difference between the mind and the brain?
Okay. When I'm talking about brain, I'm talking about hardware. I'm talking about the actual physical brain. The mind is the function of the brain, so that's the software. So I'm using loosely the equivalent of the brain is the hardware and the mind is the software. The two work together and need to be considered together, but the contributions we can study in specific ways. Is that enough now for coaching purposes?
Is the mind the thinking part of the brain?
I'm having a little trouble because of the reception. Say it again, please.
Does the mind do the thinking? Is that what the mind does?
Is the job description, the function of the brain. And different parts of the brain have different functions. There's a synchrony and a symphony of things. There are very specific parts and functions, but the mind is the function, the brain is the anatomy, and the two are intricately interwoven and become important for us to know. And that's why I believe when we really understand and appreciate to apply the mind, brain, and performance sciences to strategic coaching, you'll be the best in the world, because those three are areas of science and research. There's an amazing amount of information, research in different ways and from different areas of the world in the last several years to apply that I think can be of significant benefit to us as coaches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you. The second question I had is, how do you create dopamine via saving? If you create dopamine for spending there's dopamine that is created when you are when you're spending, how do you change it to create dopamine and the anticipation of saving? That's probably core to the coaching, which is the transfer of what the attention is of what you're doing, correct?
The answer is you're not creating dopamine by saving, and that's why dopamine was properly named the way it was, because it's the anticipation of something happening, whether it's the anticipation of spending or the anticipation of setting down at a slot machine. In fact, it's so much the basis of what we do in coaching. Stephen King put it very simply. He said, you know, all an author ever needs to do is keep the reader wondering or asking what happens next. That's the dopamine in microdosing that keeps someone's attention and sustained interest, whether you're reading a book, whether you're working with a client, or whether you're planning something. So that means that to create a system means the what's next needs to be in a system of what's in your best interest instead of what's the immediate hit.
So what's in your best interest may very well be savings is in your best interest.
Yeah, and some people, correct? For example, will be able to save better when they have a pile mm-hmm. for vacation, when they have a pile for mm-hmm. New furniture. So there's some kind of mm-hmm. anticipation that they build in by having piles or purposes and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
let me back off and see if there are any other
yep.
questions or comments. Thank you very
got
much.
It. Thank
Peter.
You.
Those are great questions. Any others that I want to be sure I'm not omitting anybody who wants to add or ask something here? Well, we are out of time. If you can, if you're interested, plan to hang around for 10, 15, 20 minutes after the last seminar next week at the top of the hour and jot down anything you want to discuss. I'll have as reference some of the questions to be sure that I've covered them all, but I'd be interested in what you have to say or think and how you're putting this together, how's it hitting you. So I look forward to our final seminar and then a discussion afterwards. And, again, feel free to send me anything before then. So thanks very, very much for all of your kind words and positive responses and all the things you're sending. And I look forward to picking up right here with you next time. Thanks.
Thanks. Thanks, Doc.
Have a great week, guys. See ya.
Thank you. It was excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Thank
you.
Your check is in the mail. See ya.